But more than that, you know, I'm conscious that, you know, we're all feeling pandemic fatigue and we'd love to move on. I sort of looked through the lens the whole time in writing the book and in my reporting to answer the question of what does this mean about us? And at the end of the day, while the book is an artifact of the pandemic, I think it's really a story about who we are, our worst impulses, what happens when we just sort of have this religious adherence to free markets, when experts say we really should have had a very visible hand on this and directed supplies and figured out who needed things and made sure that our money was being used wisely.
Well, J. David McSwain, I want to thank you for being with us. Investigative reporter with ProPublica, new book out today, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and KBOO Community Radio is very proud to be the first FM station in the state of Oregon to program jazz. Let's celebrate KBOO's diverse jazz programming and the jocks who volunteer their talent to share their love of jazz music. Jazz Appreciation Month, or JAM as it's affectionately known, represents a sweet spot in the lives of KBOO's music lovers. So join us on Wednesdays, noon to 4, and Saturdays, 2 to 5, throughout the month of April, as we toast America's greatest art form here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Commissioners say the threshold for opening emergency shelters should be reevaluated after warming shelters didn't open for Monday's snowstorm. A plea deal is rejected by three former Minneapolis police officers charged with aiding and abetting the murder of George Floyd. And in international news, the Ukrainian port city of Mariupol is once again in the spotlight as Russia looks set to intensify its attacks in the country's east. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 12th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Despite forecasts that showed a high likelihood for snow and below freezing temperatures in the Portland area, emergency severe weather shelters did not open in Multnomah County on Sunday night. Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties are supposed to open emergency warming shelters when temperatures drop below freezing, which is dangerous for unhoused people. The historic winter weather in early spring ended up bringing several inches of snow to the Portland metro area. According to the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a partnership between the City of Portland and Multnomah County, the decision not to open cold weather shelters was based on earlier forecasts that predicted the snow would only affect higher elevations. Dennis Theriault, a spokesperson for the office, said setting up emergency shelters requires several hours' notice. On Monday morning, Commissioner Dan Ryan tweeted that emergency shelters would not open Monday either, because the snow was forecast to be rained away and temperatures would remain above freezing. He added that it was time to reevaluate the threshold system that impacts emergency shelter activation. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty also tweeted that she agrees with reevaluating the threshold system. Currently, the Joint Office of Homeless Services will open severe weather shelters in three situations. If temperatures are forecast at 25 degrees or below, forecasters predict an inch or more of snow, or overnight temperatures drop below 32 degrees with an inch of rain. The office said Monday that it had activated its crisis response street outreach system to distribute cold weather gear since warming shelters would not be open. Prosecutors said Monday that they had offered plea deals to three former Minneapolis police officers charged with aiding and abetting the murder of George Floyd, but the defendants had rejected the deal. Former police officers J. Alexander King, Thomas Lane, and Tu Tao are charged with aiding and abetting both manslaughter and murder when former officer Derek Chauvin used his knee to pin Floyd to the pavement for 10 minutes on May 25th of 2020. King knelt on Floyd's back, Lane held his legs, and Tao kept bystanders back. Lead prosecutor Matthew Frank did not disclose the details of the plea offers, but said they were identical and were made on March 22nd. The plea agreement was offered after a jury convicted the three in a separate trial in February on federal civil rights charges stemming from Floyd's death. The judge in that case has not set a sentencing date, and all three remain free on bail. Chauvin's trial was the first in Minnesota to be entirely televised, from jury selection to his murder conviction to his sentencing to 22 and a half years in prison. Now, Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill must decide whether to allow the same sort of access for the trial of King, Lane, and Tao. Cahill noted that while he has publicly said he believes the legal presumption should be to allow televised trials, he pointed out that it's not the rule yet, saying, quote, "I'm still sworn to uphold the law," end quote. Defense attorneys said they still oppose audiovisual coverage of the upcoming trial and renewed concerns about the willingness of witnesses to testify if the trial is broadcast. Due to federal court rules, live video coverage was not allowed for the first trial of King, Lane, and Tao this year, when all three were convicted of violating Floyd's civil rights. Nor was it allowed for Chauvin's federal case, in which he pleaded guilty to civil rights violations. Prosecutors said, quote, "The Chauvin trial demonstrated the benefits of robust public access to this important case and proved that the court could successfully navigate the concerns animating the state's initial opposition to audio and video coverage. The court's commendable transparency inspired public confidence in the proceedings and helped ensure calm in Minneapolis and across the country," end quote. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the European Union Tuesday to impose tougher sanctions on Russian oil and banks as the invasion of Ukraine continues. Ukrainian forces have held out for weeks, but fears are growing for civilians trapped without basic supplies as Russian troops appear poised to mount a major new offensive. The fate of Mariupol, Ukraine's besieged southern port city, is once again in the spotlight as Russia looks set to intensify its attacks in the country's east. Mariupol Mayor Vadim Boychenko has said that more than 10,000 civilians have been killed in the key port city since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine. Mariupol officials have raised the prospect that Russian forces used chemical weapons, an escalation the West has long feared but which remains unconfirmed. The British and Australian governments say they are investigating reports that Russia may have used chemical agents in its attacks on the city. Zelensky said he takes the possibility of chemical weapons being used as seriously as possible and urged the West to send more weapons to help Ukraine. In addition, Zelensky has accused Russian forces of leaving thousands of landmines behind in the north before pulling out of the region. Ukrainian officials have also said that Russian military hackers tried and failed to attack Ukraine's energy infrastructure last week. The attack was designed to infiltrate computers connected to multiple substations, then delete all files, which would shut that infrastructure down. Russian President Vladimir Putin called the situation in Ukraine a tragedy on Tuesday, but defended Moscow's invasion as a so-called noble mission. The Russian leader further maintained that his plans in Ukraine were on track, despite his military's apparent failures on the ground. According to a senior U.S. defense official, Russia has launched more than 1,500 missiles so far during the invasion. The United Nations Human Rights Office currently estimates that at least 1,500 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. However, estimates from individual Ukrainian regions already dwarf that figure, with officials in Mariupol alone estimating that at least 10,000 civilians have died in the city. While the UN has been careful to point out its own estimates are likely significantly below the real number, critics have said the low figure minimizes the true scale of suffering in Ukraine. While consumers across the nation are paying more for food, fuel, and other essentials, a new report documents multiple chief executives from large corporations bragging about how the economic fallout from COVID-19 has opened the door for companies to increase profit margins by raising prices. Eric Galatis has more on the story.
A new report confirms what it says CEOs have been telling shareholders for months, that inflation has been very good for business. Lindsay Owens with Groundwork Collaborative, the group behind the report, says families in Nebraska and across the U.S. are on the hook as powerful corporations tap the pandemic's economic fallout to rake in record-breaking profits. Last year, corporate profit margins reached their highest level since 1950.
Meanwhile, prices were soaring for American families. CEOs and firms are not just passing on their rising costs, right? They're not just asking consumers to pay for inflation effectively. They're going for more.
In just one example uncovered by researchers of CEOs boasting during corporate earnings calls about price hikes and profits, the CEO of Constellation Brands, the parent company of popular beers Modelo and Corona, said the company planned to take as much as we can from its Hispanic customer base. Owen says if the playing field were level, other companies could take customers away from firms that raise prices, but she says virtual monopolies consolidated over past decades make that all but impossible. Tyson's CEO told shareholders it was raising prices to cover increased costs plus a little extra.
And that a little extra is accelerating price hikes and bringing in record profits for Tyson. And because there are really only four major meat packers, these guys are effectively all running the same pricing strategy. And there's really no one to undercut them.
Constellation Brands and Tyson have not yet responded to a request for comment. Last week, Owens testified at a U.S. Senate Budget Committee hearing on price gouging and corporate greed. She says the first option available to lawmakers to hold companies accountable is to make use of the tax code.
Taxing excess and windfall profits will make profiteering less appealing to the large companies. The second is thinking about enacting a federal price gouging statute and enforcing the laws already on the books.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
Oregon's top judge for settling disputes between citizens and state agencies is facing child pornography allegations. Chief Administrative Law Judge John Mann was booked into Washington County Jail in March on 10 counts of first-degree encouraging child sexual abuse. He was released after paying 10% of his $20,000 bail just hours after being booked. A spokesperson for the Beaverton Police Department, which investigated the case, said Mann was arraigned on Monday in Washington County Circuit Court. The 56-year-old judge was appointed by Governor Kate Brown in 2017 and oversaw roughly 60 judges in Oregon who adjudicate thousands of cases each year brought by residents or businesses that disagree with state agency rulings, mostly involving unemployment insurance, child support payments, or the Department of Human Services. Charles Boyle, a spokesperson for the governor's office, said Mann had been placed on unpaid administrative leave during the investigation. U.S. citizens applying for passports can now select the gender X on their applications. Previously, F and M, standing for female and male, were the only available options. The X marker is officially defined as, quote, unspecified or another gender identity, end quote. The change took effect on Monday with the government's website reflecting the additional choice. the State Department announced last year that it was adding the third gender option. This followed a lawsuit by an intersex and non-binary Colorado resident who argued that it was impossible to get a passport accurately reflecting their gender identity. The State Department is the first federal U.S. agency to offer the gender X marker on any identification document. In addition, the requirement for medical documentation has been dropped. Whatever gender marker applicants choose will appear on their passport, regardless of the gender listed on previous passports. Other countries that offer passports with gender options beyond female and male includes Australia, Canada, India, Malta, Nepal, and New Zealand. According to the State Department, the gender X marker will also become available as an option on other federal documents beginning next year. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview from David Rosenberg with University of Rhode Island professor Nikolai Petro on Ukraine and Greek tragedy. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with possible snow showers and a low of 34 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with more possible snow showers and a high of 45 degrees. Today in history, in 1861, the U.S. Civil War begins when Confederate forces fire on Union-held Fort Sumter in South Carolina. 4 years after the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter, the Confederacy was defeated and the death toll stood at 620,000 Union and Confederate soldiers, making it the bloodiest conflict in U.S. history. The quote of the day is from American soldier, businessman, and Union General William Tecumseh Sherman, who said, quote, "It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation. War is hell." The Pentagon says the next phase in Ukraine could become more deadly. President Biden takes on ghost guns, and a federal trial begins over a challenge to Georgia's 2018 election. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I don't think Mr. Putin needs many signs that it hasn't been going well for him in Ukraine.
Pentagon spokesman John Kirby says Russia has failed many strategic objectives and is reinforcing troops in the Donbas region. Ukraine's foreign minister said it would be difficult to consider negotiations with Russia following recent atrocities, but Kirby held out hope.
This war could end today. Mr. Putin could do the right thing now. He could sit down in good faith with President Zelensky immediately, and this war could end.
Kirby says with the appointment of a new Russian commanding general in Ukraine, the next phase of the conflict could become even more protracted and bloody. President Joe Biden announced federal regulations to target privately made firearms known as ghost guns. Manufacturers of the do-it-yourself kits will have to be licensed and must add serial numbers.
All of a sudden, it's no longer a ghost. It has a return address. It's going to help save lives, reduce crime, and get more criminals off the streets.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz and other critics argued the weapons are already subject to the same laws as any other gun.
There are zero data, no evidence whatsoever, that this is contributing to crime at all. This is a made-up problem.
However, the Justice Department reported a tenfold increase in ghost guns recovered from crime scenes between 2016 and 2021. The House Appropriations Committee wants to take up its fiscal year 2023 spending bills in June, with potential floor votes in July. The White House is requesting $813 billion of defense spending and about $831 billion for domestic and foreign aid programs. Florida's Republican state leaders say legislative staff will not draw a new congressional map. Instead, they're leaving it to Republican Governor Ron DeSantis to reapportion the state's 28 congressional districts. DeSantis is pushing for a map that would give the GOP more seats than maps approved by the House and Senate. A federal court challenge to the 2018 Georgia gubernatorial race is underway. Democrat Stacey Abrams contends her Republican opponent, now Governor Brian Kemp, used his position as Secretary of State to promote voter suppression.
Anytime a party in power feels that their best way to win is by constricting the vote, we are all in danger and we should all be in arms.
Kemp denies the allegation. Abrams is running again this year and will face Kemp should he win the GOP primary. Trump's approval rating among Republicans is holding strong in key GOP states, according to new polling, which suggests he remains more popular than other party leaders. Should Republicans take back the House in November, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy promises to hold the Biden administration accountable, but says he won't support efforts to impeach President Biden for political purposes. Members of the GOP want investigations into the Afghanistan withdrawal, COVID-19's origins, and border security. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A Washington state agency wants the public's help to rename geographic features that use a derogatory term for Native American women. And another First Nation in Canada is preparing to search for unmarked graves at a former residential school. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Washington state agency wants the public's help in its effort to rename 18 geographic features in the state that use a derogatory name that refers to Native American women. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
The word in question you have probably heard, and it's something that has been considered to be derogatory to Native Americans for years.
I'm not going to say that word now. It's not a word I'll say.
That's Sarah Palmer, chair of the Washington State Committee on Geographic Names. The word has been commonly used by non-natives as the word for a Native American woman, but in fact is considered highly offensive. And at the moment, it appears in the names of 18 geographic features in Washington.
It is a term that has been used in a very negative way and in a sexualized way sometimes about Indigenous women.
Palmer's committee has been charged by the U.S. Department of the Interior to help determine new names for 18 features, and they want the public to submit some ideas. Palmer says suggestions that came from the federal level tended to miss the mark.
These proposed replacement names don't really capture our local history. We end up with place names like Columbia because, you know, the Columbia River goes near all sorts of places, right? Or Bonneville. Or Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And they're not really names that make sense, and they're not really names that do that work to preserve our state's history.
The committee wants to hear proposals that include traditional place names, indigenous place names, or names that reflect individual historical women. Palmer says the general public and Native tribal members are all invited to participate. The deadline for public comment ends on April the 25th. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
The City Council in Klamath Falls, Oregon, recently voted to rename a park, dropping the name of a frontiersman and government agent known for committing atrocities against Native Americans. Councilors unanimously voted to rename Kit Carson Park to Ulalona Park, the Associated Press reports. The park's new name is after a Native village, which was once near the site before the creation of the present-day city. The city started the name change process last year and solicited names from an online survey, which received nearly 400 responses. Another First Nation in Canada is preparing to search for unmarked graves at a former residential school. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, this time it will be in northern Manitoba.
The Pimichikamak Cree Nation has announced plans to search the site of the former St. Joseph's residential school. It was operated near Cross Lake by the Roman Catholic Church in northern Manitoba between 1912 and 1969. The chief of the Pimichikamak Nation is David Monius. He says the preserve has identified the names of 85 children who died at the school. However, he adds that surviving records are incomplete.
Many of them are listed as boy, as girl. Good 40% of them have first names only. Now, where do these kids come from?
Investigators say they will use ground-penetrating radar to search the site, which is now a neighborhood with homes.
You know, they don't describe it as a school. More like assimilation camps, torture camps, or death camps. And really, that's an international crime.
No start date for the search has yet been determined. It was just over a week ago that the Pope apologized at the Vatican to a Canadian Indigenous delegation for the role of the Catholic Church in the abuses at Canada's residential schools. Thousands of Native children were abused at the schools. Many died. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As Russia's war on Ukraine continues, oil and gas prices in the U.S. and across the world have skyrocketed. The price increase was partly attributed to the invasion of Ukraine, as Western countries imposed economic sanctions on Russia for its aggression. However, several major oil companies, including Exxon, Chevron, BP, and Shell, reported record-breaking profits even before the invasion. The White House has called on the industry to invest in immediate production rather than sit on record profits. The Biden administration has pointed to the more than 9,000 approved but unused permits for oil production on federal lands. Oil company CEOs testifying before Congress last week told lawmakers that they have no plans to halt payments of dividends to stockholders or to restrict stock buybacks. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
In case you haven't noticed, a major consequence of the Ukraine war is the bonanza it has provided for the oil and gas industry. U.S. sanctions on Russian oil and gas have given the industry yet another reason for more drilling and less focus on environmental protection. Yes, a tight oil market and inflationary prices are good for electric car production, but the oil and gas industry is doing even better, not just because of high gas prices, but also because they can demand more access to public lands for drilling, and blame the administration for the high gas prices if the companies don't get to drill more. This is a false argument on four counts. First, the Biden administration is granting oil and gas drilling permits at a higher rate than was true under Trump. No more drilling on public lands, Biden had said during his presidential campaign. Drilling leases are now being offered on 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico alone, and this allowance was 2 months before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Second, we've all learned not to expect gas prices to go down, even when more gas comes on the market. That supply and demand argument doesn't fit with industry promises or practice. Third, as Earth Justice points out, the oil and gas industry is sitting on 9,000 drilling permits that it chooses not to use. Why not? Because, as it puts it, drilling costs money the industry doesn't want to spend. In 2021 alone, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron made a combined $75 billion in profits. Instead of spending some of this massive profit on drilling leases they already hold, oil companies are buying back their own shares, funneling dividends to their shareholders, and paying lobbyists to demand cheap new federal leases so they can stockpile them for future profit. The real winners in this war are the stockholders and executives of the big four oil companies. Third, besides the U.S. market, Biden needs to satisfy the European Union countries as they look for ways to de-link from reliance on Russian gas. Biden has promised to find and ship other sources, and the Germans are leaning heavily on him. That means increased U.S. gas production from shale and other sources, a calamitous option for the environment, and construction of new LNG terminals over the next several years. For now, the New York Times reports, climate concerns appear to be taking a backseat as U.S. and European leaders seek to punish President Putin for invading Ukraine. Building new terminals will mean streamlining environmental regulations to facilitate loans and construction. A fourth factor favoring big oil's domestic production is the unwillingness of Saudi Arabia and the other Middle East oil producers to step up their oil output. Tense relations with those countries over Iran, Yemen, and now the Russian invasion of Ukraine have given them excuses for once again demonstrating what unreliable allies they are. That's good news for Moscow, but not for Biden as he searches for more oil to satisfy our insatiable demands. In short, the pressure is on Biden to push domestic production, and although he's released oil from the strategic reserves, that won't be nearly enough to stave off industry and political pressures. The industry has launched yet another disinformation campaign, calling gasoline prices Biden's war on oil and discrediting his clean energy agenda. The administration has had to concede some ground rather than embrace conservation. Here's Jennifer Granholm, the energy secretary, pleading for more oil production. Quote, "Yes, right now we need oil and gas production to rise to meet current demand. But," she says, "we're serious about decarbonizing while providing reliable energy that doesn't depend on foreign adversaries. We know what more drilling means. As Earth Justice puts it, quote, it wrecks ecosystems, coasts, groundwater, and critical habitats. Our country has laws in place precisely to protect people from corporate greed and ensure that the environmental and human costs of fossil fuel extraction is taken into account. Biden has options to protect the environment and conserve energy, even without his Build Back Better plan. He has already used executive orders over 50 times to overturn Trump-era environmental deregulation actions. For example, recently the administration issued a new rule to substantially cut tailpipe emissions in cars and small trucks. New fuel efficiency standards are on the way. Still, there's no getting away from it. Truly significant climate crisis legislation that will make a meaningful contribution to carbon neutrality and demonstrate leadership on saving the planet is not going to happen. Big Oil is doing its part to ensure that we continue to have energy and environmental insecurity. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 12th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with University of Rhode Island professor Nikolai Petro on Ukraine and Greek tragedy.